I think that talking about this at this time in cultural history is very interesting because the internet provides the communication vehicle for the first time to make this actually practical. And also there are several precedents which have been very significant, which may seem quite unrelated, but I don't think they are. The first one comes to mind for me is, of course, the Berlin Wall, which came down through a popular voice movement without any violence, when all the other approaches, violent or not, had failed. Number two, in the United States, you have the decision against the tobacco industry, which had a similar kind of presence and hold over a large population, nowhere near as large as what you're talking about here with mortgage holders and the entire banking scene in a country. The tobacco industry had a smaller number of people in its thrall, shall we say, and yet the decision was made against them, which was fought in the courts by the highest paid lawyers they could find, and delayed, but still that wall came down and is gradually being dismantled. So now here's the next opportunity for the people to get their act together, as it were, and stop being sheep and simply being led from pastor to pastor so they can be shorn periodically.
Indeed, the world is changing. And I've often said to people, you know, they talk about, oh, no, you can't stand up to authority like this. They'll put you down or something bad will happen to you and all this. And I said, what you're saying is that we're all sitting on the same bus and we're talking about how we're going to jump the driver because he's taking us where we don't want to go. But if you really look at the situation, you got to consider the possibility that maybe there's nobody driving the bus. Maybe the seat is just empty or it's some kind of a mannequin or something like that. Because, I mean, for me, one of the most eye-opening aspects of this doctrine I was talking about elsewhere is that if that's the best they can do, then it's a sorry-looking conspiracy. It really is. I mean, you know, criminal acts are not fundamentally illegal because the law doesn't say you can't do it. It just says you go to jail if you do. There was just in-your-face evidence that there is no proactive conspiracy behind this. The powers that be are in the business of putting out fires after the fact. They just react to things. They are reactionary and not as proactionary as all those conspiracy people would have just believe, you know, that there's somebody out there manipulating strings. It's been my experience over the last 15 years of examining how they deal with the fallout of crises in this sense of getting caught stealing from the public is after the fact. They come up with whatever they have to arrive at the conclusion that the law was not violated. And in this case, you know, that's just utterly stupid. The fact that the system wouldn't say so at the time and instead ingrained it as a doctrine of law is just further evidence that if we have a concerted effort to get our equity back, we will succeed. In fact, we cannot fail.
Now, from what you've said, I have the sense that if the equity problem were handled, then the taxing problem would also be much easier to deal with. What do you have to say about that? And can these two different movements begin to work in tandem?
Taxation and money creation are two sides of the same coin. We are living in a hugely inflationary bubble, so to speak, but we also have this hyper vacuum, on the other hand, that is sucking it out of circulation and concentrating it into the accounts of the top 1%. And I'm being generous there. It may be the top 0.1% of the population. There may be 30,000 people in Canada, 0.1%, effectively dictating policy to the 99.9% of the other 30 million. And it's very important to understand process and how this is achieved and the role of taxation in the process. When you make a deposit in a bank, the property interest in the deposit passes from you to the bank, and that is the instant at which the equity is scooped by the banking system. You can go out and bust your back to earn $100,000 in cash. You then have to take it to the bank, practically speaking. You don't have any other choice, and you have to sell it to them in exchange for a promise that cost the bank nothing to produce. And at that moment, the bank becomes $100,000 richer, and there is $100,000 worth of new purchasing power injected into the economy by virtue of the fact that you now have a complementary account credit that you can spend and access. I gave testimony before a criminal trial in Vernon last November as an expert witness in the economy and in taxation. The point is that people are always saying the government ought not to be printing money. And this is sort of, you know, wheelbarrows full of cash to buy a loaf of bread. And they give the imagery of Germany in the inflationary period of the 20s. The government is always printing money because every month they're writing checks against the Bank of Canada. The federal government in Canada, those little yellow checks that come out for pensions every month, et cetera, every one of them is drawn on an account at the Bank of Canada, and therefore is money. It can no more default than a cash note. So the government is spending, let's say, $12 billion a month issuing checks to the public in payment of pension accounts, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you have to do with this check? Well, every month the government gives you $12 billion collectively, and you are required to go sell it to the bank in exchange for a promise when you deposit it into your account. In that sense, the government is already printing the money for the entire budget. It's just that you have no choice but to hand it over for nothing to the chartered banks. And that's how that system or that subsystem works. Now, what is happening with taxation is that the federal government is going out there, and let's say that they were to stop taxing today. What would happen to those checks that are written every month? There would be no difference. You would still get your pension check, you would spend it, or deposit it in the bank. There is absolutely no necessary connection between the government's ability to spend and the fact of its taxing. Therefore, you have to stop and look at Section 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act. This is the big taxation thing. This would be the 16th Amendment in the United States. In Canada, it's under the Constitution Act, which is in fact a statute and not a constitution, but I'm not going to get into that. The power of the federal government under Section 91(3) is the raising of money, capital M money, by any mode or system of taxation. Now, we are always deceived in Canada into this silly argument over the meaning of the words any mode or system of taxation. Never mind what it used to mean, you're missing the obvious. The obvious part is that they're not raising money. All they are doing through the taxation system is destroying purchasing power for its own sake to control the price inflation that would otherwise occur because they are printing money by issuing checks against the Bank of Canada, which are then deposited into the private banking system that doesn't have to return it to the Bank of Canada, but instead can issue its own credit that is balanced by their acquisition of that new property on a monthly basis. They're two sides of the same coin. You get rid of the deposit system and turn it into a reposit system where property interest in the money itself remains with the person who earned it and who reposited it. And you get rid of this free lunch system for the chartered banks and the rest of it, and you can effectively eliminate taxation or very nearly eliminate taxation. And imagine what would happen. What would happen in Canada if you were to get rid of the taxation system and instead do it this way? Well, first off, you would see a radical reduction in the amount of purchasing power that is being printed. Last year, the total amount of purchasing power through the inflation system increased by, let's say, $600 billion through the stock market expansion, etc. You can write a check against your brokerage house. That's real purchasing power. You can spend it if you want to. The total increased by $600 billion. But because it was concentrated in the top 1%, nothing gets produced, and you just get this increasing concentration of money in the deposit accounts, which, of course, have to be supplemented by taxing the other half of the equation, which are the so-called alleged borrowers, through interest payments in order to pay the interest to the so-called depositors, et cetera, et cetera. If you were to restrict that and go to a 100% reserve or deposit system, then what would happen is you could cover all government expenditures through the issuance of only $150 billion of new money into the system, and that would be the only source of new money in the system, instead of four times that amount or $600 billion. So you would reduce the rate of purchasing power inflation by a factor of four, and you would get rid of taxation at the same time. Now, immediately, you would have 44,000 Revenue Canada employees who are out of a job. Well, give them 5 years and pay them the same salary to do nothing. Find yourself something useful to do and more intellectually enlightening than just going out and keeping people in a form of bondage. You would have immediately 10,000 lawyers who do nothing but tax law in Canada. You would have 100,000 accountants who spend more than 80% of their time on tax considerations. You've got 35,000 CICA members by itself. That's Canadian Institute of Chartered Accountants. You've got management accountants. You've got financial accountants. You've got accountants up the yin-yang. They're wasting their time. They're spinning their wheels. They're going through the motions, and they're not producing anything tangible. You got 44,000 revenue candidate employees. You've got 10,000 tax lawyers who would be out of a job. You've got, now think of this, 10,000 lawyers who have 10 years worth of university education behind them on average. You've got to get a four-year undergraduate degree before you even go to law school, then another year of articling. A lot of them have master's degree. On average, you've got about 10 years of education behind them. Think of the resources behind that. You've got 100,000 person years dedicated to tax lawyers. Think of the support staff at the universities, the professors whose time are invested in that, the staff sweeping the floors, the cafeterias. All those things come out of the real economy for the purpose of keeping people in bondage. You got 100,000 accountants who have an average of 4 years university education each. That's 400,000 person years of university education dedicated to nothing. And we can have a five-year wind-down period where people are paid their regular salary, whatever you've made for the last 5 years, and find yourself something useful and intellectually enlightening to do, and we can create a much better country.
For additional information on this topic, go to your online resource center at www.pqionline.cc, click on Products and Solutions, and go to Disc number 10.